Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the Mueller inquiry now that Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn has pled guilty to lying to the FBI and is cooperating with the special counsel. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss the emails leaked to the New York Times that shed light on how much Trump's transition team knew about communications and active involvement with the Russians that are illegal under the Logan Act, which prohibits private citizens from working with a foreign government against the United States. We'll assess how much jeopardy Jared Kushner faces since he lobbied members of the UN Security Council behind the back of the US government on behalf of Israel, and whether Trump ordered Flynn to contact the Russian ambassador and Vice President Pence knew about Flynn's activities. Then, with Trump now tweeting criticism of the FBI, we will speak with Usha Rangappa, a former FBI special agent who specialized in counterintelligence investigations, about the role of the FBI's about the central role that FBI counterintelligence played in revealing secret contacts the Trump transition team was making with the Russians and others, and how the acting attorney general at the time, Sally Yates, was fired for warning Trump based on evidence from FBI counterintelligence that Flynn was compromised by the Russians. We will also examine what Trump's Deputy National Security Advisor, KT McFarland, meant when she wrote to Trump's top advisors about how Trump should pay back the Russians by easing sanctions because Russia, quote, has just thrown the USA election to him. Then finally, as the Republican so-called tax reform bill makes its way through conference towards an expected signature by the president, we'll look into how this massive reward to the donors will further embed and entrench an American oligarchy, while the 99% who have not had a raise since the late 1970s will be left paying more for less of their share of the American pie, and will soon see their social safety net cut in order to pay for the deficits caused by the Republican $1.5 trillion gift to the oligarchy. An expert on American and global oligarchy, Jeffrey Winters, the author of Oligarchy, joins us. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Ian, great to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Scott, now that the big shoe has dropped, that General Michael Flynn, who was Trump's most senior and I think longest serving advisor, and had a very short tenure as his national security advisor, but was probably the closest aide to Trump during the campaign and the transition, has basically pled guilty to the FBI for lying, to the special counsel for lying to the FBI, and has admitted that he's now cooperating with the special counsel. Let's start with these emails that were leaked to the New York Times, obviously by somebody on the inside who had a bird's eye view of what was going on during that transition. What do these emails tell you about the depth of complicity here, particularly people like Vice President Pence, who have some illusion that they're immunized because they claim that Michael Flynn lied to them, but evidence is mounting that most of the inner circle knew exactly what Flynn was up to?
Well, remember the immediate pushback that was put out by the White House in response to the plea bargain and the headlines that it grabbed came from Ty Cobb, his lead counsel, and the thrust of that pushback was to say, Flynn's all out there on his own. He was doing this on his own. This in no way implicates any other person in the White House. And I think, you know, you have to wonder sort of what's going through the mind of the people who leak this. I mean, the people who leaked it had to be in a position of confidence inside the White House to have had access to all these emails. And what they're doing is basically putting a big stamp across his statement that says, liar. That's just not true. Because these emails demonstrate that Flynn, they basically make clear that Flynn is exactly what we've always understood him to be, a military man who understands his position and the chain of command, and who doesn't go run around doing things without checking them out with his superiors. And in this case, very, very clear, he was taking direction continuously from higher-ups and the staff. And his position was so senior that there are not a lot of people who were higher up than he was on these issues. But in particular, we see, and the documents that were submitted by Mr. Mueller cite two individuals who've been identified as Jared Kushner and K.T. McFarland. And so we know they're implicated. But K.T. McFarland is particularly interesting in that she was the deputy of General Flynn. So in no way was she giving instructions. Rather, if we understand what her role was inside the transition team, she was the person who was assigned to keep Trump company at all times and to be a conduit between him and the rest of the foreign policy team. So I think the strong assumption is that these messages that were being communicated by K.T. McFarland to Flynn were coming from Trump himself.
Well, K.T. McFarland has an extraordinarily thin background in national security. And she, of course, worked for Fox News and was the conduit for Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch to General Petraeus when he was serving in Afghanistan. She went to him as an envoy of both Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch, basically saying, we will back you, Fox. Rupert will pay for it, and Roger will run your campaign against Barack Obama in the 2012 election. And here you have a sitting general working for his commander-in-chief, Barack Obama, being told by K.T. McFarland that the kingmaker, Rupert Murdoch, wants him to run against his boss. Now, that, of course, that whole conversation was leaked, presumably by perhaps even Petraeus himself to Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. But that doesn't speak well, does it? I mean, of her, at least to my mind.
No, and indeed we know since Flynn was out and McMaster came in, we know McMaster wanted to have nothing to do with her, wanted her out immediately, didn't trust her, and thought that she was involved in some very questionable dealings that were going to explode. He tried to appoint her to a number of different positions. She's in the dock to be ambassador to Singapore, to be far, far away from Washington. And I think, there's certainly a deep story behind this, but I think the information that was published in the New York Times on Saturday helps us understand what he was so concerned about, because amongst other things, we have that email in which she's saying Russia threw the election to Trump.
Right. And it's time to pay back, right?
Exactly.
Ease the sanctions. I mean, if that's not clear to all these extraordinarily resistant conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats, to, for the life of me, I do not understand, still insist that there's no there with this Russian investigation. What more evidence do you need? I mean, this is an extraordinary admission on her part. Hey, guys, it's time to pay Russia back because they threw the election in the USA to Trump.
I think that's right. And it also helps us understand the meeting that was going on with Kislyak in different terms. So we have a lot of people pushing back now saying this wasn't a violation of the Logan Act, that it was free and clear. An incoming president has the right to have such meetings and have such discussions. It's just a matter of policy and a shift in policy. In fact, we have Andrew McCarthy spelling out this line in an article in National Review that was published yesterday. But I think this email and a number of other things put this in much broader context. And I think what we're looking for is evidence that there was, during the campaign or potentially even before the campaign, a quid pro quo bargain that was struck with the Russians which is you help us be elected in various ways. Hacking is and release of the hacked materials is one, but it looks like money, you know, just direct payment of money to Trump or through other sources into his campaign to support it, or to his business empire to support it, was another source. And there was a quid pro quo that included an agreement to change the sanctions regime, probably to recognize Crimea, and to pull back on support from the government in Ukraine, amongst other things. So, you know, if there was such a quid pro quo bargain, and her emails certainly suggest very strongly that it existed, and that Trump post-election is trying to send a message to the Russians that I'm going to make good on what I promised you, that puts the whole thing in a different context.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Well, it's so extraordinary that when you just mention money coming from Russia, either to the campaign, the Trump campaign, or to Trump's businesses, that if you see this whole operation as it, which is what it was, which is a very multifaceted Russian intelligence operation, which both the GRU and the FSB got on board, the SVR, foreign intelligence, were pretty leery of it. They thought there'd be blowback, as Putin's chief of staff, General Ivanov, a former KGB general, very much Trump's, very much Putin's superior, thought it was a terrible idea, and Putin fired him. But he went ahead and did it. And if you just look at one aspect of the many, you know, the DNC hacked and all the other stuff that they did, particularly the digital stuff with troll farms and bots, etc. If you just go to one aspect of the Russian operation that's mentioned in the Steele dossier, and that is how they recruited Jill Stein and the Green Party, and she was on RT all the time through the election period, and she managed to get more votes in those three swing states than Hillary Clinton lost by. So just that one aspect of Russian involvement put Trump over the top. So the idea that keeps being put out there that the Russians weren't decisive in this election, I find that really ridiculous.
Well, I agree with you, certainly. And I think the Steele dossier is really getting as much intense scrutiny from journalists now as it's ever gotten. And that's largely a result of facts coming in that just show it was correct on so many different points. Now, I'd have to pause and say there are also quite a few points on which it hasn't yet been stood up or refuted. But there are now a very large number of points on which it is, it's come through. And I think certainly the reporting on Jill Stein is a piece. Also, a lot of the business dealings with Trump, which he vehemently denied, and subsequently his denials have been exposed as false. And the report of that dossier that he was, in fact, pursuing deals. He was pursuing deals involving and the exact Russian financial institutions that Christopher Steele cites. All that's coming through. In fact, I point out that I think that we're going to be seeing in the next week on NBC a major show reviewing all the Steele dossier reports and itemizing what's been proven, what's been refuted. Actually, I don't think anything has been refuted, and what remains to be established one way or the other. That should be coming in the next week or so.
So, what's your sense then of whether or not this is, you know, Ty Cobb, Trump's lawyer, keeps floating this idea that the Mueller inquiry is about to wrap up, and it's obviously not the case. It would, if anything, they're just hitting the ground running, and this is the first phase of it. And there are, you know, three sort of threads here. There's the follow the money thread. There's the political operatives thread, and then there's the digital thread with Jared and Bannon and the Mercers, etc., and the Russian troll farm. So there are many threads to this, and we're only seeing one part of it in terms of Flynn's cooperation and what that might lead to. So why is Ty Cobb doing this? My suspicion, Scott, is that Ty Cobb is preparing us for Trump's intention to shut down the Mueller investigation in, you know, before the end of the year by basically saying, well, you know, it's supposed to be over. In other words, they've set an artificial deadline, and he hasn't, you know, he's going past the deadline. He's just wasting our time and our money, so let's can him.
That's exactly correct. And in fact, we know that Ty Cobb reached out to the Republican leadership in the Senate and the House and spoke to the heads of the investigative committee. There are four committees that are on this in some way or another, and got three of the four to come out and make public statements to the same effect. That is, that they were going to be winding up their report at the beginning of the new year. It was completely obvious at this point that there was no way any conclusions could be drawn about this, and the thing couldn't just remain open forever. So this was all designed as a strategy to pressure Mueller to wrap things up, and also to justify a decision to shut him down, which could be by defunding the operation or an issuance of a new order by the Attorney General, fixing a deadline by which everything had to be done. But this effort has collapsed at this point. So we have, Senator Burr, who is probably doing the most important of the investigations right now, has already come out and said, he had been thinking of shutting things down at the beginning of the year. He's not going to do that now because it's obvious that things will continue to go. So I think Mueller, by bringing these rapid-fire charges, and this is an extraordinarily tight time frame in which to bring charges of such gravity, he's established that the case has established important initial objectives of demonstrating that there's something there, and he's established also within sort of broad markers what remains to be investigated and established. And I think we now see that, you know, we're looking at a period certainly of several more months, certainly through the end of the winter and into the spring, before we're going to come to conclusions. But I'd also just stress, there's never been an investigation like this. There's never been an investigation that has moved as quickly as this one has, nor an investigation that has achieved so many striking successes early on.
Well, just in closing, Scott Horton, when they keep talking about the Logan Act, and many say, well, you know, it hasn't been even enforced since the 19th century, so what are we talking, why are we, it's an antique gathering dust. It would seem to me that there are other, from what we've learned so far from this Flynn and his cooperation with the special counsel, aren't there other contemporary laws that they're much more in jeopardy facing? For example, the laws on campaigns that they violated?
Exactly right. So I think we do have a pretty clear-cut violation of the Logan Act, but there's never been a prosecution under the Logan Act. So I wouldn't expect that he would bring charges under the Logan Act. I think he's going to focus, once he's developed all the facts here, and he's established that there was a large-scale program of intervention and support for Trump, we're going to be focused on campaign and election finance regulations, which make these things clearly illegal, and which have teeth in terms of offering a basis for prosecution. And we've also got, you know, the old standbys of, General Flynn discovered, making false statements in the course of an investigation and other acts of obstruction generally. So we have all these procedural things where there's a very, very solid basis to act. But I think it'll be a combination of election finance, and procedural matters that will figure as the investigation proceeds.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's outburst of criticism against the FBI and speak with a former FBI special agent who specialized in counterintelligence investigations. You can't hide.
Your smile is a thin disguise. Russia with love. I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
And Joan, welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Asha Rangappa, who's an associate dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. Previously, she served as a special agent at the FBI's Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigation in New York City, and now is a political analyst at CNN. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asha Rangappa.
Thank you.
And Asha, I've just been handed an article by you, What's in Flynn's Plea Deal Shouldn't Scare the White House, What Isn't Should. And I want to talk to you, obviously, about this flurry of criticism of the FBI that Trump is tweeting out today. But in the context of the article that I was just handed, it does seem that usually lying to the FBI, which is what they also got Mueller, got Papadopoulos on, isn't that, if the way to look at it is, if you want somebody to cooperate with you and flip and name people further up the food chain, you don't hit them with all the stuff you've got on them. You hit them with something, at the low end of the scale that's basically says, we own you and you're not going to go to a jail for the rest of your life, but we have to nail you on something. Is that how the system works?
Sort of. Not quite. So you do hit them with everything you've got. What you say is, here's what we can charge you and convict you with because we have the evidence. And in Flynn's case, he had lied to the FBI. We know that he had failed to register as a foreign agent, which there's a law in the United States called the Foreign Agent Registration Act. That carries a penalty of 5 years, and each count of lying to the FBI carries a penalty of 5 years. He was also alleged to have been plotting to kidnap a Turkish opposition leader and deliver on American soil and deliver that person to Turkey. That's a crime that carries a penalty of 20 years in prison. So Flynn may have been looking at a potential sentence of 30 years or more. And so what Mueller would have said is, look, this is what I've got, but if you cooperate, I'll reduce this to just one count of lying to the FBI, and I'll recommend that you only serve 0 to 6 months in prison. What do you think? And so, that's going to be a pretty, Flynn is going to think very hard about that. And importantly, Mueller isn't going to make that offer in the first place unless he believes that Flynn can give him some very important and significant information that will take him higher up the chain than Flynn himself. And Flynn was pretty high. He was a national security advisor. So there's not much higher you can go. There's only a few people left.
Well, let's turn to this flurry of criticism being tweeted out by Donald Trump today against the FBI. I think it's based upon a revelation that the special counsel Robert Mueller fired an FBI agent some time back because he had tweeted or made a remark or written something critical of Trump. And any reasonable person would assume that speaks well of Mueller, that he wants unbiased investigators. And you would think that since the guy was fired for saying, making an anti-Trump comment, that Trump would be pleased with that. But no, he's turned it into a great conspiracy against him, and somehow saying that this FBI agent is also involved in the Clinton cover-up. So what do you make of that? And of course, the other tweet, let me just read it to you briefly. After years of Comey with the phony and dishonest Clinton investigation and more running the FBI, its reputation is in tatters, worst in history. But fear not, we will bring it back to greatness. Go ahead.
Well, I think you can always tell how nervous the president is getting by how crazy his tweets are. So, you know, he's trying to discredit the FBI, obviously, because the FBI is going to be, and of course the prosecutors and Mueller's team are going to be the ones that will bring further charges. And as I said, they are creeping, like Burnham Wood, very close to the very top of the White House at this point. I agree with you, Ian, that when you look at Mueller, that he took someone off of his team immediately who may even who could even present the perception of bias, that suggests that he is vigilant about that. He wants this investigation to be unbiased. He wants it to be untainted by allegations of bias, and he took steps swiftly to do that. And it's interesting because Mueller actually was appointed as director by the FBI by a Republican president. He was appointed by George W. Bush right after 9/11, or actually right before 9/11, and he is the longest-serving FBI director since J. Edgar Hoover. He served under Obama as well. His appointment was extended. So this is someone who has a lot of credibility, a lot of trust. He is a conservative. He himself is not, you can't accuse him of being out to get Trump for ideological reasons. So all I can conclude is that this is an attempt to delegitimize Mueller and his team so as to cast doubt on any further charges that are forthcoming.
Let's talk about the role of FBI counterintelligence, which is central to what we've learned about the Flynn plea and the revelation that he's cooperating with the special counsel. Sally Yates talked about it in her testimony. She was very circumspect because it was all classified, but she went to the White House to basically warn them that Flynn could be compromised by the Russians. That data that she had, or those intercepts that she had, clearly came from FBI counterintelligence. Also, the role of this fellow MBZ, who is one of the leaders of the Emirates, who's apparently his ambassador in Washington, is very influential. He showed up here unannounced, didn't go through the regular channels. He was apparently somebody that when the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee tried to scuttle the House investigation, which I think he's largely done, he ran off to the White House and talked about unmasking, and they were trying to shift the subject away from Trump's culpability to the idea that Obama was and Susan Rice were illegally unmasking people. I understand that that was who they were unmasking. So what do you know about it seems to me that the FBI counterintelligence is central in the evidence that we have so far, irrespective of the New York Times revelation of these emails.
Right. So it's going to be very central. This is primarily a counterintelligence investigation. So Mueller is trying to find out what the Russians did, how they did it, who they did it with. Now, most of that information is going to be gleaned through sensitive methods and sources. So it could be human sources from the CIA. It could be signals intelligence. It could be electronic surveillance that, top secret electronic surveillance that the FBI is conducting. So part of what Mueller's challenge is in terms of making a criminal case, when he encounters activity from the counterintelligence investigation that are violations of criminal law, he really has to build that case through separate channels. So, for example, even if he has recordings of, or sources who've revealed, that members of the campaign have done X or Y, what he really wants is to be able to bring a person who can testify on the stand in a court of law. And that's, typically you just don't, it's a long process to declassify these things and to make it admissible in court, because then the defense has to know where it came from, and the government may not want to reveal that. So that's why someone like Flynn is really important to Mueller. He was very high up in the administration. He was also very high up in the campaign and the transition. So he's had a bird's eye view of what everyone was doing. And his plea deal reveals that he was actually coordinating with people in the transition and campaign in making his contacts with Russia. He wasn't just doing this on his own. And so that's what makes him really valuable for Mueller, because he is a human being who can provide, you know, fresh testimony that doesn't have to go back to this classified sources in this counterintelligence investigation. It can help him make his own criminal case.
But just in the last couple of minutes, when you look at the timeline in terms of this critical period in the transition, and of course, it's so striking what K.T. McFarland said in an email to all of the top people in the Trump transition team, saying that that Trump should pay back the Russians by easing sanctions because Russia, quote, had just thrown the USA election to him. But just to go through some of the timeline, it's so extraordinary that Sally Yates is fired the day after Trump invites Comey to the White House for a dinner that made Comey very uncomfortable, which he testified about. And the next day, Sally Yates gets fired. And then the day after Flynn is fired, Comey has that other meeting with Trump at which he shoved everybody out of the room, including the attorney general, having Comey alone, sort of apparently leaned on him, tried to get him to go easy on Flynn. So it's pretty hard not to see a connection there, isn't it, with the Trump's activities and then the idea that he wants the head of the FBI to basically, you know, go ahead and quash the whole thing. It's clear to me that he's trying to contain the story and contain the damage. And he sees first Sally Yates as a wild card that he doesn't control, and then Comey as somebody that he needs to control.
Well, I think that's definitely the inference. I will just point out that Sally Yates at that time had issued a public statement that she was not going to direct the Justice Department to enforce Trump's travel ban,
right,
which had been issued that day. And so while you may be right that perhaps her knowledge of Flynn could have been a driving factor in him wanting to get rid of her, her firing came almost immediately, I think within minutes of her making that public statement. So I would probably link it more directly to that. So, but in terms of the timeline with Comey and Flynn's firing, I think that's right. He fired Flynn, and Trump fired Flynn, and then the next day had a dinner with Comey where he asked Flynn to, or he asked Comey to lay off on the investigation. Now, inferences aren't something that is going to meet the threshold in a court of law of beyond a reasonable doubt. You actually have to have proof. And so what Mueller needs to show is that Trump knew at the time that he both spoke with Comey and asked him to lay off the investigation, and at the time that he fired Comey, that he knew of what Flynn was up to, that he knew that he was having these contacts with Russia. He knew he was lying to the FBI. He knew he was coordinating all of these things with his own campaign. If he has that knowledge at the time that he's making these requests to Comey and then he subsequently fires him, that is what establishes the intent in for obstruction of justice. You have to show that the person acted with corrupt intent. And that's what you would need to show. And of course, it's hard to look into somebody's heart, so you have to use some of these circumstantial pieces of evidence. But if Flynn can provide Mueller with some insight into how much Trump knew about what he was doing, that will significantly strengthen Mueller's obstruction of justice case against the president.
Well, Asha Rangappa, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Usha Rangappa, who's an associate dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. And previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations, and is now a political analyst at CNN. And she has an article at the Washington Post, What's in Flynn's Plea Deal Shouldn't Scare the White House, What Isn't Should. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the extent to which the so-called tax reform bill is a massive reward to the donors and will further embed and enrich an American oligarchy.
Rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can remember the mansion on the hill.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He's the author of Oligarchy, and he joins us from Jakarta, Indonesia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Winters.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure to be back again.
And Jeffrey, it seems to me that the so-called tax reform bill that passed the Senate and will be in conference with the House, and the president has asked to have it signed by Christmas, which seems to be likely to happen. It's been kept from the Democrats and from the public. It's been done in secret in an enormous rush with all kinds of lobbyists piling in at the last minute and writing stuff in the margins, some of which is incomprehensible. And nobody had a chance to read it, at least of all the Democrats. So it's been a rather disgraceful display of legislative arrogance on the part of the Republicans. But the results really will have, I think, long-lasting effect, decades-long, if not changing the entire face of this country. I know we've had periods of oligarchy and then democracy's been restored to some extent. But this looks like the real entrenchment of a permanent plutocracy in our tattered democracy. How do you see it?
Yeah, Ian, I guess the first thing we need to observe is that we are now fully 4 to 5 decades into an incredible shift of wealth upward, not only in the United States, but globally. So we have an incredible concentration of wealth that's been happening while the average household in the United States has basically experienced a flat line in terms of their buying power. So you would think that if we were 5 decades into a rush of wealth upward, that what we would be reasonably talking about in a democracy would be tax increases on the top. But that's not what we're talking about. We are instead talking about a tax reform, so-called tax reform, where 80% of the benefit is going to the very people who have been concentrating wealth at the very top. And there's just nothing democratic about that. It is a show of power. It is a show of arrogance, really, on the part of the ultra-wealthy in the United States. And for the Republican Party to ram this through in the way that they've done, claiming somehow that this is beneficial to the average household, is just obscene. And one of the questions that really people have to start asking is, how long can this go on? How long can you just shove money upward to levels that are mind-boggling and have average people really struggle from paycheck to paycheck and bear the burdens of this tax cut for the ultra-wealthy? It really, you know, people need to understand that this is a reflection of power. Only power achieves this kind of outcome. And precisely the kind of process, Ian, that you described, non-transparent, quickly rushing through, no debate, no discussion, hundreds and hundreds of pages of complex tax language written by lobbyists and accountants who are hired via the wealth defense industry, this is just a travesty.
Well, the power you're talking about is the power of the donors. And Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, will go down in history as the turning point, I think, in the entrenchment of American oligarchy, because it's enabled them to basically buy our politics. But one of the more obscene aspects of this new tax bill is getting rid of the 1953 Johnson Act that separates church and state, and more importantly, the tax-exempt foundations from political activity. This is being done allegedly at the behest of the religious right, but apparently the real people pushing this change are the Koch brothers, because that will mean that all of their 501c3 and c4 tax-exempt foundations that are engaged in these political front groups, that the myriad of front groups that the Koch brothers have, Freedom Works and all these other foundations that they have, they will be then freed up now to overtly engage in politics. So what you have here is not only have the Koch brothers and their ilk bought the United States government, now they get a tax deduction for having bought the United States government.
Yes, yes. I mean, there are so many things that are jammed into this bill. And, you know, the thought that has gone into it is extremely careful. People have been spending a great deal of money through various think tanks and so on to work out precisely the kinds of intricacies that you're talking about. I mean, anyone who thinks that someone like, you know, Congressman Paul Ryan is sitting up late at night working on the text of this tax document is sorely mistaken. These documents are drafted in think tanks and other shops who spend years deciding how they're going to benefit the most powerful people in the country. And so when the opportunity presents itself, as it did just now, thanks to the Trump victory and the control of all three branches of government by the Republicans, they now know that this is their opportunity. This is the bonanza moment. And this stuff has been sitting on the shelf waiting to get put through. Now, this isn't, you know, what appears to be very last minute about this is in fact very carefully structured, very carefully thought through about how to maximize power, how to get maximum deductions even while you're using power in the way that you've described. So what appears slapdash about this, it's actually quite the opposite. This is very carefully done.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchy and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He's the author of Oligarchy, and he joins us from Jakarta, Indonesia. My sense, though, is that there's double jeopardy. I mentioned the double jeopardy now with the Koch brothers having bought the government. Everything that's passed the House so far in this Trump administration has really rewarded them: offshore drilling, the tar sands pipeline, crippling the EPA, you name it. The Koch brothers have been the winners so far. And now, of course, on top of that, they get to deduct the money they spend on buying our politicians. So it's quite a deal for them. But the other deal that I see as double jeopardy is that the super rich, and we've seen this from the release of the Panama Papers and now the Paradise Papers, the super rich around the world, they hide their money in these offshore havens, tax havens. So that's their first step. They hide their money. And then what's taxable left onshore, they now have their political agents like Paul Ryan and company lower their taxes. So they're hiding their taxes in the first place. And then what they're paying now is being reduced. So this is an obscenity. And I think only until we break that nexus of offshore banking, which is how all of these crooked oligarchies and despots around the world operate, what Sarah Shays writes about in her book, Thieves of State, only when we break the nexus between big oligarchical families and powerful corporations and criminality will we be able to have any kind of restoration of global democracy. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah, well, you see, this entire offshore world is something that is relatively expensive to buy and pay for, but it more than pays for itself in terms of the high cost fees that those who use the offshore secrecy world, they more than pays for itself in the kinds of non-payment of taxes that you've just mentioned. So there are literally trillions and trillions of dollars that are held in secrecy locations around the world, not just by Americans. Americans are by far the biggest users of these secrecy havens. But billionaires all over the world are using them. Corporations all over the world are using them. And here's the most obscene part of it. None of the money, people need to really listen carefully to this, none of the money in offshore tax havens is actually offshore. It's all onshore. That is, the money is in New York, it's in London, it's in Japan, but it goes through the offshore location first. It then achieves secrecy. It's then redeposited back in onshore accounts, but with none of the names of any of the people or corporations associated with it. So that basically tells you that our own governments, governments of the UK, of the United States, of countries all over the world, are actually participating actively in the offshore world. They're allowing it. And the question is, if average Americans tried to hide their money, first of all, let's back up. There is absolute transparency of your income and of your money for absolutely every ordinary American across the country. You can move and have 10 different jobs in 10 different states, and the IRS would still know absolutely every penny you made. There is no secrecy for the average American, unless you mow someone's lawn for cash, no one knows that you got paid. But that is a very, very small amount of the economy. Everybody who gets a paycheck has complete transparency. So the wealthy at the top have virtually no transparency for a huge amount of their wealth and the income they gain from it, and then they pay no taxes. And we participate, our government, our regulatory agencies participate in this system, and they could close it down if they wanted to. It wouldn't be hard, but they don't want to. And the question Americans have to ask themselves is why.
Well, but it cohabits and commingles with this global criminality, and we could reach a critical mass on this planet where there are more criminal regimes than there are democracies, and democracies are very frail and they can be undermined and then they can disappear. And when you look at across the world, and particularly with a president like Donald Trump, who seems to be enthralled and in bed with people like Putin, Duterte, Erdogan, Xi in China, all of these despots who are parking money in these offshore accounts. You know, Putin's supposed to be the richest guy on the planet. I'm sure Xi is a close second, or his family. I mean, this is what's happening to the planet. And my sense is that there are two issues here. One is what the issue that you've just been talking about, and the extent to which the wealth defense industry, as you call it, protects these people, and our politicians protect this system. But the system is also has a dark side, does it not, of despots and kleptocrats around the globe?
Oh, yes, it does have a dark side. But, you know, we shouldn't, I guess one of the points I was trying to make, Ian, is that we shouldn't necessarily view this offshore secrecy world as being sort of what they are creating alone. It's a joint venture. That is, countries like the United States, like the UK, Switzerland, Austria, Germany, France, all these countries are helping to create and maintain the entire offshore secrecy world. So there's not really, there's already not a major divide between the China's, the Russian Federation, and so on. That divide in terms of supporting an offshore secrecy world already doesn't exist. So, you know, you're right that Trump sidles up to these, figures all over the world. He genuinely likes them, and they genuinely like him. But you know, here's part of the sad part of the story. Barack Obama didn't do much to undermine this global system, frankly. And so the Democrats, I'm sorry to say, have upheld this system as the Republicans have. It's just that the Republicans do it much more in your face than the Democrats do. It is time for a very serious look at this system, its unfairness. And I'll repeat what I said at the outset, which is, in any genuinely democratic society, at this level of wealth concentration upward, we would be seriously talking about redistributing, using our tax system to increase taxes on the folks at the top, and opening up doors of opportunity for those down below. In any democratic era, we would be doing that. We are doing absolutely the opposite. And that's an expression of the hyperpower that is in the hands of these oligarchs today.
So what is their end game? What is their vision for an America a couple of decades from now? I mean, Warren Buffett once warned that we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy. Well, we are a plantation economy. The oligarchs are sitting on the veranda of the antebellum mansion, and the rest of us are toiling in the lower 40. And we are becoming slaves, and we are being downsized. We haven't had a raise for 40 or 50 years, as you pointed out earlier. And it won't be long before the Koch brothers will be stepping over homeless people on their way into a five-star restaurant. And then on the other adjunct to the arrogance of the Koch brothers and the oligarchs that have been the beneficiaries of this so-called tax reform is another oligarchy, another plutocratic family, the DeVosses. Betsy DeVos is the Secretary of Education. She's trying to destroy what's left of our education system in order to have a Christian-style education like they have in Saudi Arabia, where you just have all this magical thinking about the prosperity gospel and Jesus is going to rescue you, and you stop teaching science, etc. And that seems to be an adjunct to this. You, on the one hand, the oligarchs take all the wealth, and they manipulate people by keeping them stupid and enthralled with magical thinking.
Yeah, and also when we talk about the long-term game and the potential conflict that could happen, don't underestimate the potential of people at the top to play with race, with identity, with ethnicity, with religion, all those things that potentially divide people at the bottom. There's a huge investment being made in agitating along those lines, and we see it very clearly in the Trump administration and the people that help bring him to power. They're very happy to agitate on the basis of immigrants and talk about walls as if that's the number one threat, and it's not. The threat to the United States is and other countries around the world is precisely that a very few people are doing well and a lot of people are not doing well at all. But instead of focusing the anger toward that dimension of inequality, well, you know, there is a huge effort being made to get people to hate each other horizontally at the bottom. And it turns out, let's face it, that's a very effective tool. That's a very effective strategy. And it hasn't shown itself to be wearing out in terms of its effectiveness yet. I'll also point out something people need to realize just to get a sense of the dimensions of what we're talking about. Someone like Jeff Bezos, just year to date, his wealth has increased $33 billion this year. On an average day, his wealth fluctuates between $1 and $3 billion a day. That is an extraordinary number. Most people can't even imagine ever making $1 billion across 5 generations or 10 generations. And this man's wealth fluctuates between $1 and $3 billion a day. Someone like Mark Zuckerberg, year to date, his increase in wealth, $22 billion. I mean, it just goes on and on. People like organizations like Oxfam have pointed out that just a handful of billionaires in the world equal the entire wealth of the bottom half of the world's population. We're in an extraordinary extreme moment. And again, what we ought to be thinking about is strategies of clearly just letting the market go is concentrating too much wealth upward. What we ought to do in a democratic society is find ways of not utterly eliminating any differences in wealth, but modulating it so that the total wealth we produce as a society helps the vast majority of us, not just a few at the top.
Well, Jeffrey Winters, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchy and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He's the author of Oligarchy, and he joined us from Jakarta, Indonesia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.